Everyone, and thanks for being with us for our webinar today. A couple of ground rules as we start. We're muting all the participants so that background noise doesn't come into play. Many of us are at home still, and that does tend to cause background noise, unfortunately, as we move forward. So for questions and answers, we'd appreciate it if you would use the chat button and address those questions to everyone or to myself, and we can address the questions and answers for the session later. If you think of a question, write it down during the process, and we'll address it at the end of the seminar. So if something piques your interest, please ask the question. Today we really have our usual weekly webinar, an opportunity to connect with some of the aerospace industry experts, and we've got three distinguished experts with us today to hear their perspective on what's going on, assess the impact on the industry and on your company, and give you an opportunity to ask questions during our panel discussion. We're going to start with some questions from. With a statement from each of the participants, then we'll ask some questions of the experts, and then open it for general Q&A in a few minutes. Today's panel includes Nico Buchholz, Dave Tritel, and Patrick. Oops, sorry about that. We're having some difficulty with our slides here. Patrick Edmund. Nico has a 30-year career. He's been with the supply chain, lessors, OEMs, airlines, Airbus, Rolls-Royce, Gold Leasing, Lufthansa Group, Bombardier. Nico is a veteran of multi continents and multi organizations, and has a great perspective on the industry. He's currently based in Hamburg and is performing several advisory assignments for various industry participants. Dave Tritel was formerly with the Apollo Aviation Group, where he was responsible for capital raising and strategy as managing director. Dave headed SH&E for a while, has been around the industry for many, many years, and is one of our noted aviation experts. Patrick is the founder and managing director of Altair Advisory, an aviation strategy advisory consulting firm. He's based in Ireland in the Shannon area out in the countryside, has more than 20 years of experience with airports, airlines, aircraft leasing, and consultancy. And has headed up the network and strategy function for three regional airlines and is a board member of the ERAA. So with that, we'd like to get started with the hardened resilience lessons from past crises. And if we can start with our panel, the industry has been traditionally resilient to periodic shocks. Most of those in the past have been regional rather than global in scope and nature. Is this time different, and what will the impacts be? And if you could provide each of our panelists provide a few minutes on your thoughts on what the impacts are, we would certainly appreciate it. Nico, can we begin with you in this process?
Okay, I'll be the optimist, but I'll also try to be the realist in that. And I'll start with the famous saying, 2 miles of runway give you the world, 2 miles of concrete somewhere else give you nothing. So I still believe in a strong rebound for aviation. But having said that, I think the airline world and the aviation world is to a hard reset, having to rethink some of the business models, having to challenge some of the ways they actually worked within the business models. And what the difference this time is really, it is probably the first global crisis affecting everybody. because we had SARS, we had September 11th, we had the financial crisis, just to name a few. They were all like blips in certain areas and not. So this one is different. And as a result, we lost and we are still losing a large proportion of the GDP. And we all know that GDP is a big driver when it comes to aviation demand, airlines, and other things. So that means probably a couple of thousand aircraft deliveries lost on the OEM side over the 20-year forecast period. That means a lot of, well, I don't want to use a word of somebody, but let's say right sizing still of some airlines who have worked on too large a scope to be sustainable. So all this will change currently, and it will take a while, and I'm sure we will have a later discussion on that. It will take a while until we come back. But do I believe in that comeback? Yes. And what is currently really required is a cohesive approach globally from authorities, countries, foreign ministries, to actually provide the certainty for people to be able to travel, to kick off the machine again. Thank you.
Thanks, Nico. Dave, could you provide your perspective on the situation?
Thanks. And thanks for having me, Ernie. Every past downturn we've had always starts with a pretty large collapse and then a gradual recovery in the business that, you know, takes 1 to 2 years for traffic to come back and a little bit longer before earnings come back and aircraft values collapse and then they come back. I think the pattern is going to be similar here. It's just going to be extended quite a bit longer. The industry, basically, you know, the segments that I deal with, primarily airlines and aircraft finance, very high fixed charge business. You know, those fixed charges don't go away. And consequently, when the government handouts run out, I don't see how the industry continues to operate without substantial restructuring. So I'm pretty pessimistic in terms of the degree of restructuring. I think it's going to cover virtually every sector of the industry, airlines, manufacturers, lessors, airports, supply chain. You know, capacity cuts just don't come with the concomitant reduction in fixed charges. So, you know, we should expect the next couple of years having an enormous amount of restructuring, lots of debt to equity conversions throughout the industry. You know, travel will certainly recover. You know, most of the guys that have done the work so far expect the manufacturers' production rates will be back to 2019 levels by 2023 or 24. So, you know, we'll be dealing with that. But along the way, there's going to be a complete redesign or a restructuring of the airline space. Certain business models can't survive. The passenger ACMI business, I don't see how that can survive. It'll restart eventually, but near term, you know, that's a very struggling business. The leisure sector has got a huge lag because the tour products aren't available and they aren't being sold and they aren't being designed. So we're going to have a huge lag in terms of selling that kind of product. So working capital for the airlines, which, you know, basically fuels our operation, is going to be another drag on capital. So it's...
I'm going to go inside.
we should just expect the next couple of years of restructuring across all sectors of the industry. Some of the financial products are going to be seriously tested. In my world, in the aircraft leasing world, the ABS market is going to be seriously tested, those structures. So, I think we're going to have to bring back export credit finance in a much more significant way. And, so we have a lot of work to do for the recovery to occur, or while the recovery recurs, but it will. And and we'll see, business models evolve, and we'll come back. And I just think it'll take longer than it did in the last two downturns. So that's my message, if you will.
Thanks, Dave. Patrick, if you could.
Ernie, I was sitting here just thinking about where I fit on the pessimism optimism scale relative to Nico and to Dave. I remember many years ago an airline CEO described me as dangerously optimistic. So you'll have to weigh my words against that, I guess. From an airline point of view, I'd absolutely concur with Dave. I think there are very uncharted waters ahead. And I think what is particularly tough is the level of uncertainty. If you're an airline, you don't know whether you're dealing with a social distancing environment for the foreseeable future, whether a vaccine or fast, efficient tests will become available. So, what are you anticipating in terms of the passenger experience and what it does for your possible loads? I note earlier today, Jetstar in Australia pointed out that if they have to enforce the 1.5 meter social distancing guideline, their 180-seater A320 goes down to 22 seats, which has some interesting impacts on the well-being of the revenue management team, to put it diplomatically. My compatriot, Mr. O'Leary, has said in his charming way that this doesn't seem like an awfully good idea. I don't think those are exactly the words he used, but you get the gist of it. But I think if we have to deal with this kind of health question mark for passengers over the next few years, we're going to see evolution in what the onboard product looks like. If you think back a few years, or a couple of decades, premium economy originally came about as an interim level of comfort between economy and business class. And I think a new axis is emerging where safety or isolation on board is going to become relevant. If I want to travel in the next month or two, assuming flights open up here, if I want to travel short haul, my choice will be to go with Ryanair, for example, or to go with a private jet if I want more isolation or more perceived safety. Now that's quite a gap in the market. So I could imagine some kind of premium economy product emerging, whether for long haul or even in short haul, which is more like a Q suite or like a Delta One. So something that provides more isolation for passengers. Now that's clearly not something that comes in a couple of months' time, that comes in a year or two. But if you're an interior manufacturer, you might be thinking about that. From the airline point of view, more broadly, I think, as has been remarked already, we're going to see some retrenchment of network carriers back to their hubs to perhaps try and protect slots in some cases as well and preserve what cash they can. The result of that is going to be just like if your blood circulation is poor, it's the capillaries that will, the extremities that will die off first. We're going to see the loss of those secondary and tertiary destinations across a lot of airline networks, I believe, and that has a big impact on regional airports and on regions. There may be some opportunities coming for regional airlines operating smaller aircraft and perhaps allowing the majors to downgauge a little bit, but the big question is whether those smaller carriers are going to be able to survive the clear out that's coming. If you're a very large flag carrier, you can knock on the door of your Minister of Finance and hope for some kind of bailout. But if you're a much smaller carrier, even if you're strategic, you may or may not be able to get that kind of attention. Here in Europe, the fact that the governments are bailing out the big carriers, although in a case-by-case way, also means that they're starting to take a view on how those carriers should behave, let's say, from an environmental point of view. So, for example, the French government is telling Air France that it needs to be moving away from domestic flying where the train can do it in less than 2.5 hours. And I expect more of that as well. And I'd also expect more, perhaps, integration or cooperation between network carriers and LCCs. As the network carriers retrench, they're going to be looking for ways to continue to get feed and drive traffic. And I think we'll see more emergence of self-connecting passengers and solutions for that. But I think what I'm seeing at the moment from talking to a number of airlines is some are still bunkered down and some are thinking about how they rebuild, how do they come out of this as fighting fit as possible. But it's going to be a very different landscape, I think. Somebody mentioned in the last few days that a lot of the factors at the moment actually are ideal for starting airlines. Planes are cheap, fuel is cheap, labor costs are low. Unfortunately, there's no demand, small detail. Let's hope that changes, but I think we're, even for this dangerous optimist, I think we're still several years away from recovering to 2019 levels.
Thanks very much, Patrick. I think we're ready for some questions for the panel. Addison, do you want to ask the first question, or should I?
I'm happy to have a crack. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today, and thank you to the audience for joining us as well. So one of the things that Ernie and I have been dealing with in terms of people asking us is the recovery. Is it a V? Is it a U? Or is it like the Nike swoosh sign? Can you, probably in the same order of speakers, give us a thought on that? Thank you.
Okay, well, I mean, it's definitely not a V shape. I've said more or less from the beginning, I see it as a slanted L shape, which is like a hockey stick. We have gone down, although extremely fast, because everything ramped down extremely fast. But the ramping up will take a while, and before we come back to reasonable levels, and I'm not even saying the 2019 traffic, but before we come back to reasonable levels, it probably takes to 2022, 2023, and for long haul even more, because we need to calibrate the whole travel system, including all the rules globally, because somebody can travel, somebody cannot travel. So all of this needs to be aligned before real travel starts again, be that business or leisure. I mean, it doesn't really matter who starts first. At the moment, nobody starts because there's just no framework for it. And after that, it will take a while, as I said, 2022, 2023 for domestic, regional flying, and probably a year or more longer for the long haul. So I'd call it a hockey stick or a slanted L. It's not a V shape, and I don't see it as a U shape that we suddenly just bounce up to the original curve. And hence my initial statement, I would see a couple of thousand aircraft on the production lines lost. Because, I mean, just take this year. This year is probably foregone in terms of reasonable number of deliveries, and there is already more than 1,000 aircraft. Thank you.
So in thinking about this, if you look at past recoveries in our industry and almost any industry, the Nike swoosh is the best way of looking at recovery. You go down fast and then you go up relatively slow. Here we have a couple of additional uncertainties. We don't know if there's going to be a vaccine. We don't know if there's going to be a second round, you know, of the virus. So most likely we're going to have an elongated bottom. And then with a gradual recovery, not so different than what Nico was saying. But I think that's a fairly, you know, good bet as to what to expect in this industry. With a big unknown as to how long before we have a, you know, a meaningful and real growth pattern beginning, and that bit being mostly a function of underlying economic recovery, the availability of the vaccine, and the, you know, question as to reemergence of the virus. So I think those factors have to be determined, really, to have a better gauge as to how long we're going to have a bottom before we have a meaningful and material onward move, upward movement, you know, in terms of recovery. So
I'd echo those comments, and I'd note that I think this is going to be quite differentiated region by region. We see some regions that are starting to talk about travel bubbles, Australia and New Zealand, for example, where they've had relatively low rates of virus-related fatalities and where their tracking and tracing operation is working well. And they can now start to contemplate opening up flights between those countries and perhaps progressively extending that further into Asia. And I think we'll see the traffic developing firstly on a short haul and intra-regional basis before it goes, as has been said already, to inter-regional. So I think the timescale for this coming back is on the longer end. I'm concerned that our ability to discuss the recoveries is based on the shape of letters in the alphabet, and I think we maybe need to expand the alphabet.
Thanks. The industry is going to someday return to normal, but is it going to be normal as we know it today, or a new normal? What will that new normal look like for airlines, for OEMs, for suppliers, and lessors? What's your prediction on what's going to happen?
Well, we stay in the same order again, or
okay? That's fine. Whoever.
I think the new normal will be a real focus on what really makes the airline, what is the mobility requirement which we have, and the new business models. And maybe one element in there, I think the industry has been resilient. Yes, this is different with a virus, but I think most of us would recall deep vein thrombosis being called the death of the low-cost carriers a couple of years ago, which was a health issue. And people found ways around it. So that's why I'm optimistic. Yes, it may be, as David hinted, it may be the vaccine or something. But again, something will happen that it can grow. Having said that, the suppliers to cover the whole aspect of your question, the suppliers will see pricing pressure because of the overcapacity and a lot of, let's call it, cheap spares, because there's lots of aircraft which are not yet the age of scrapping, but they are just parked and won't be used for a long time. So there's a lot of cheap spares around, which will impact the business cases. And because there's lack of traffic and there's an overcapacity of aircraft, there will be pricing pressure on the OEMs, which then have to put that pricing pressure somewhere into that supply chain in a, let's call it, well-dosed manner in order not to kill the supply chain. And that, I think, is the biggest challenge which we have. And I forgot the lessors. I leave David a little bit in there, but the lessors will probably see the big pressure on them, because they have enjoyed reasonable margins compared to many airlines. And hence, airlines may want to pressure for some margin transfer. That's my two cents on that one.
I'll give a perspective on the businesses that I'm most involved with. You know, I'm a principal in an aircraft leasing company, right, Matt? And you know, also involved in a PE firm that would like to make more investments in the aviation space. So from aircraft leasing aspect, we've got two kinds of lessors. We've got the big balance sheet guys, which are, you know, going to go through, frankly, a lot more hell than I think they have up to this point. You know, in terms of our portfolio now, we have 70% of our lessees, you know, with some form of rent deferral or abatement. Well, actually more than that, but we 30% are paying still. So everybody else is going through the same struggle. It's just how long that's going to continue. And I think it's going to continue quite a bit period of time, which is going to mean that we're going to see, you know, restructurings on among the different aircraft lessors of some sort. That's happened in almost every of our past downturns. Other than that kind of restructuring, that business isn't going to change. You know, it's simply, it's just a financial service business where we're supplying capital. So that's going to continue. The way we do it and the sources of it, you know, that's going to be a challenge. And I'm going to have to find different sources. But I had to do that before, and it's not going to be any different now. So we'll have restructuring. Some of the guys will go away. Aircraft leasing guys that are primarily servicers, you know, some of them are already in trouble because when no rents are being paid, no fees are being paid. No fees means they can't pay their people. So I'm expecting that we'll see, you know, a reduction in the number of servicers because they won't be able to stay in business with the rent reductions. Or, you know, so we'll have fewer lessors for sure. As far as the investment opportunities, they're going to be fantastic. You know, you got a tailwind. Nobody really knows today where the price points are. You know, the deals that I'm looking at today are substantially better than they were 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago. But frankly, they're not good enough yet because, you know, the cost of debt in this industry is staggeringly high. You have an A-rated paper selling at 1,250 basis point spreads. Why would you want to do an aircraft lease and give a unlevered return of 14 or 15% when you can buy secure paper at 13%? Makes no sense. So we've got a lot of restructuring still to go on in the aircraft lease space. The guys haven't drunk the Kool-Aid yet. So we'll see, you know, continuing restructuring there. On the manufacturing side or the parts side, we're going to see an enormous number of airplanes on the ground, as Nico was talking about. That's going to have all sorts of implications. We've got 11 airlines that have filed for the equivalent of bankruptcy since COVID started. That's 507 airplanes that they operate. We've had announced retirements of about 1,000 airplanes as well. So we're going to see tremendous number of airplanes on the ground that stay on the ground. There's roughly 4,000 airplanes that are 20 years or older. It's conceivable that we're going to be cutting into the, you know, large reductions in the 15 to 20 year old fleet. So there's going to be pressure on the parts market and the engine drivers because there's just going to be so much supply. So we'll see. You know, my expectation is restructuring across the board over the next couple of years. So
I think that restructuring is going to obviously stretch across the airline industry as well. I think Nico and Dave have spoken to many of those aspects. I think we're going to see a fairly major shakeout of carriers. The fact that ownership and control rules around the world still limit the ability of carriers to merge or invest across borders means that it's not going to be so much consolidation. It's going to be more the strong getting stronger and the weaker disappearing. And I believe there may be some, let's say, structural changes behind that, where, for example, low-cost carriers may continue to take market share and full-service carriers may retrench further. And as I mentioned earlier on, I think the smaller and the regional carriers are really going to be very hard-pressed to come through this.
Thanks very much. Will health measures become a new driving force for the industry? And what are the implications for passengers and as we go through? We've seen temperature checks being instituted at factories, soon to be instituted at airports, according to TSA here in the United States. Are we going to need health papers as we go across international boundaries in the future? Where do you see the regulatory side coming out of this, or is it still a ball of confusion for us?
I think again, it's rearrangements in aircraft cabins have been ongoing for many times, and Patrick mentioned the premium economy. Maybe that is a new normal. Maybe something else is a new normal. Those elements have come. But I think as we are a global industry, it is the unique chance for some players to put a rule set down and to really coordinate that rule set. And IATA, this is a chance for IATA, actually, to really put something coordinated down in order to have all the airlines operating. That I think is important. And I mean, the thing of temperature checks and all the other things, we may see that as a nuisance, but if we're honest, I mean, I've traveled the past couple of years many, many times to China and other places where you have those checks permanently. You don't even realize them, and they are faster in their immigration and checking lines than actually some so-called Western world airports. So that I would not see as a handicap. It's the question of, do you need, apart from your passport, extra papers now? That may create a burden on administration and that may slow traffic down. But in general, I think the coordination through one large body who lobbies for all the air transport is the important part in that, because otherwise we will actually have this crisis last longer than it needs to.
Yeah, I personally haven't given this kind of question that much thought. If you think about it, a lot of what's being talked about is just another version of screening that we have now. You know, it just maybe takes a little bit longer, maybe the process changes a little bit. The only thing that I have read about or that's being talked about that is somewhat disturbing is the possible quarantine for going to a different country. That would obviously have a chilling effect on demand. But I think the trade pressures around the world are just too great for any of that to be sustainable. And it's all going to go away if we have a vaccine. So I think some of this is really going to be temporary, or some of it is simply going to be a process change and enhanced screening. So we dealt with that before, and you know, people respond. Maybe add an hour to a trip, maybe that's half an hour. You know, and then over time we find ways around it. Just like we did with post 9/11, same thing. So I don't think that's gonna be a particularly complicated issue for the industry to resolve, certainly not in the longer run, and certainly not if, you know, once the vaccine gets developed.
I think our challenge is figuring out how the industry gets from here to whenever a vaccine becomes available. In other words, to the point when it's no longer a health question to go flying to somewhere far away. And there are definitely procedures that can be followed, but ultimately, whether it's the concern of catching the virus when you're traveling, or the concern of being marooned somewhere by a quarantine because there's an outbreak, these are going to impact on demand. So even if procedures are put in place, that's going to have a chilling effect on demand for air travel for the next couple of years.
And maybe I'll add some regional aspects. I think, David, I agree in some countries it will not impact if you had an extra time to travel. In some countries, if I take Asia or Europe, if you add an extra hour to travel, you may kiss certain air transport goodbye.
Yeah, for sure you're right about that. You'll just take a different mode of transportation if it's available.
Or you'll just use Zoom for your business trip instead.
But we've had that discussion for the last 25 years, that people are going to use other types of communication, and they do, but travel still, has grown.
Yeah, and I don't think, I'm sure we've all experienced the same thing. I don't for a moment expect, once I'm able to fly again, that 100% of my meetings will be converted to Zoom calls. But will 10% be converted, 20%? Yeah, I could see that.
Agree.
The supply chain is in an interesting position because we've had the OEMs over the last few years focus on capacity and ramping up to massive levels of production that we've never seen before. A lot of suppliers made capital investments to meet that new need, and suddenly the rug has been pulled out from under them. Will the supply chain survive this massive downturn? Will we see significant consolidation? And where do you see things like Partnering for Success, which Boeing had pushed on the supply chain? Can they push any more, or is there no more room left for margin reduction?
I think the supply chain, yes, is hard hit, some more than others. But I think it goes like a guidance through the whole discussion. It's not only the airlines who have to look at their business model. It's also the supply chain. And a lot of the supply chains, the companies in the supply chain, have lived a niche life, a very comfortable life in some cases. Some others had the full brunt of competition and pricing pressure because they did not have a unique sales proposition. So if I look at the ones who now have to get to change their business models, I think that is also a unique opportunity to recalibrate how we get to the aircraft itself. So how the tier ones, the tier twos start working, and what really makes an aircraft differentiating from another aircraft. Because, I mean, you look at automotive, and automotive is a very interesting thing because it's also the mobility area. Yes, you may say it's more private investment driven than business driven, but the pricing pressure which they have is enormous, and even the biggest competitors work much more together on non-differentiating product elements. And this could be something as a blueprint for some of the supply chain companies in aviation as well. And those who are large, there may be some consolidation that you buy somebody, and we have seen that in past crises that Boeing or Airbus or others have bought some of their weak key suppliers in order to make sure that they do not die and that they still can deliver the aircraft. So in a nutshell, the couple of business cases will have to change within the supply chain, because continuing just hoping that, okay, Boeing, Airbus, whoever will produce it again, and I get back to my normal life, I don't think that is an option for most. Thanks.
I haven't dealt with the supply chain in a substantial way for a long time. I mean, for me, it's like the 1990s when I helped set up TransDigm. I was on that board, and I've done a little bit since then. So all I can see is that the environment that we've been talking about is just going to continue to accelerate some of the consolidation that we've been seeing in that space. I would think that this kind of environment is just going to accelerate that to a greater degree. And frankly, it'd be a as I think about it, it'd be a great time to deploy capital, you know, and try and participate in that area. It has been for a long time as well, and it's just going to get better. So, you know, that's when I think about the supply chain, I just think about it as a fantastic investment opportunity on the consolidation play. So, that's my only view there.
No, I'm not going to add anything in particular on this one. I'll let you continue to the next.
All right, sounds
good. Ernie, we've got several questions from the audience.
Why don't you start on those?
Okay, so question for David from Bernie that goes, why does David T. think that passenger ACMI sector won't come back quickly? Those operators have the smaller aircraft in their fleets, which could be important to in rebuilding traffic with aircraft of optimum size.
So there are different ways of looking at it. The ACMI business on the passenger front is fundamentally a charter type of business. They're supplying excess capacity. They're capacity providers that are filling in a need that arises because the other carriers don't have enough capacity to supply that activity. So now, when everybody's grounded airplanes, there's plenty of extra capacity. So the need for the ACMI operations are much less apparent. Now, on the other hand, the kind of operators that are most of the ACMI operators are very scrappy, and they're some of the best that I've dealt with in finding different uses for their airplanes. So that's the other half of the equation. Those guys have historically found ways to use their airplanes that no one else could dream of, but they do. But as a basic business model right now, the excess supply obviates the demand for that type of business. So I think we're going to have a struggle for those carriers for a couple of years until, you know, the excess capacity gets consumed and then there's a need arises for that type of service again.
Well, I might just nuance that a little bit, and maybe it's a European context as well, but I'd say not all capacity is created equal. If I'm a hub carrier and I'm facing a major downturn, I'm using this opportunity to take a chunk of my fleet out. I don't necessarily want to be flying 180-seat A320s around to secondary destinations where demand has gone off a cliff. I want to hold on to slots in my hub airport. I'd actually be quite happy to have a scrappy carrier flying sub-100-seaters around and providing some level of feed for me and babysitting those slots. So I'd absolutely agree with David that the ACMI carriers are going to have a tough time. But I think there's going to be a niche there for the ones that are offering perhaps the smaller capacity that can effectively backfill larger aircraft in a low demand scenario.
Another question here from Joe Campbell to the panel. In the near term, that is before traffic and economy comes back, how do airlines do the math on taking new aircraft they have ordered? Boeing and Airbus are both talking about rather higher production rates, which seem hard for me to imagine being low enough. How can airlines take new aircraft in this market? What's the math for deferring, canceling, et cetera?
Well, to add, I mean, I think my colleagues will have some comments on this one as well, but I think we see the dominant narrative amongst airlines at the moment as being, how can we defer aircraft? There's a relatively small number of exceptions. So, for example, Wizz Air is all in on new aircraft. Air Baltic is going for new aircraft. These are really the exceptions, and these are the airlines that think they can capitalize on the downturn to take more market share and happen to have what appear to be relatively suitable and capable aircraft for a lower demand scenario, respectively an A321LR, XLR, and an A220. But I think as I say, I think most airlines are looking at how they can push their deliveries away. I'll hand over to my colleagues for their views as well.
I think you touched the main point. Most are trying to defer, but the other element is also I think airlines will look at you raised some aircraft, but there's some aircraft in most portfolios, like people expecting what could become the new normal in terms of flying, in terms of volume. So size is the element between unit cost of an aircraft and trip cost will be looked at in a completely different light. And that's what I mentioned earlier when I said there was a required reset, because people were much too much focused on big for economies of scale. There's exceptions, but the majority of airlines was focused on that. So you had very good unit cost, but if that means you have to fill so many more seats to achieve those, then suddenly the trip cost, if the unit cost decline is only on a shallow curve, become much, much more important. And that is what we will see. And that's probably also, if you look at some aircraft deliveries, which are not postponed, because some airlines may want to move to aircraft which allow good seat mile cost, but at the same time, very low trip cost, which is the financial risk.
So, again, from my perspective, I've been a midlife aircraft lessor for the last 10, 12 years. And as long as you can get 10-year-old airplanes and have a secure supply of 10-year-old airplanes, it always makes economic sense to use them instead of a new airplane, because the pricing of a new airplane is too high relative to what the pricing of a used airplane is. I still think there'll be lots of demand for clearing out the excess used airplanes, as long as the manufacturers, cut production and keep production rates down. The market will clear itself. That's just how it works. And if they don't, then the question is who's going to be able to finance the airplanes? And, that becomes a big challenge too. So I think it sort of fixes itself, that the capital markets aren't going to be able to continually finance new production when there's not demand for it. So I think
this kind of raises the question as well. What would you do hypothetically if you were a manufacturer that had, 800 new aircraft sitting on the ground at the moment, trying to figure out what to do with them?
One of them does. They got a problem. I mean, those things, to the extent they're sold and the contracts are kept, which is a big question mark. The buyers of that, when they start taking a delivery, have to look at that as a fixed cost. Yeah. They've got to use them.
Yeah.
But 20-25% and even more, 40% of that, some of those deliveries go to leasing companies that have to finance them, and that's not going to be so easy if there's no customers for them. Their balance sheets aren't strong enough.
Gentlemen, we have not much time left. I'm going to give you one more question before we start the wrap. And if you could just be very succinct. I mean, you've given very thought-provoking answers so far, but we run that now into a time thing. So the question goes, with reduced OEM production and accelerated retirements, will there be enough planes in 2023 to 2024 to provide the equivalent of 2019 ASKs?
Want a short answer? The answer is yes. Because with a short lead time, you will be able to activate some of the aircraft which are currently parked, and will not be butchered beyond future use.
I think Nico is right on that. There's going to be so much excess capacity that's on the ground that could be reactivated, that the market will clear itself in that way.
Yeah, this is not what's going to be keeping us up at night.
No, I think, as somebody once said, nobody got financially under for having not enough aircraft.
That's true.
Interesting. Back to you, Ernie.
Another question from the audience. In the coming months and years, airlines will have to adapt to demand. LCCs and ULCCs that operate only one type of aircraft have little room to adapt. So might they have more difficulties to manage through the crisis than carriers with several aircraft types?
Well, there's different ways of adapting to demand, and one is to upgauge or downgrade your aircraft. The other, obviously, is to change the frequency. And LCCs and ULCCs across the world are more, what will I say, schedule agnostic, if I can put it like that, in some ways, than hub carriers, who are trying to keep a nice, clean schedule, flying the same frequencies, same times every day. You have only to look at a Ryanair schedule, for example, to see how it can be flying a relatively small number of days per week at different times of the day. So I think that the LCCs will adapt their capacity simply by changing frequency. The other aspect of LCC demand adaptation is the LCCs tend to be more pan-regional than one country-based, and therefore they have the ability to spread their capacity across different demand pools. So I think ultimately LCCs and ULCCs are going to be in a relatively good position coming out of this, always assuming that we get past social distancing requirements, which essentially blow the business case out of the water for any airline and for a price-driven airline in particular.
But if I may add to that one, I mean, I completely agree with Patrick, but the other thing is LCCs or ULCCs, they're called that way because of their cost structure. So the impact of what was initiated by the question of being at a disadvantage actually could turn, apart from what Patrick has said, into an advantage because they do have a very good cost structure.
So we could call them RLCCs, relatively low-cost carriers.
Yeah, that may be the change afterwards.
the new normal.
Another question, in terms of the airlines, we heard David Calhoun predict last week that a major US carrier will fail. You mentioned earlier that there are 11 bankruptcies so far. Where do you think that number will end up, and do you believe that a major US carrier will fail during this process?
From my perspective, look, I'm old enough, in fact, you are too, Ernie, to remember when we had over 50% of the U.S. airline in bankruptcy. So I think that depending on, the pace of economic recovery and the emergence, I think it's very likely that there'll be restructuring in the U.S. and Europe and Asia, and that it'll be extensive. I think it's a very material probability that there'll be, at least one and maybe several large U.S. and international airlines that are going through some form of restructuring. I mean, right now we have Avianca, South African Airways, and Virgin Australia, and they're, substantial carriers. And it would not surprise me at all to see larger ones and several more.
Okay. Edison, over to you.
All right, Ernie, I think that we want to bring back the deck and talk a little bit about next week as well. So to the panel, thank you very much for your participation today. That was really eye-popping and very informative. Thank you for that.
Pleasure.
And we'll just wait for Ernie to get the deck up.
Pull back up, Addison.
You got it up? I don't see it.
Okay.
I can talk about next week if you'd like.
Okay. Well, thank you, Fiona. In fact, is right here, and she will talk about what we have lined up for next week.
Okay, so we are talking about trust and aerospace. What is it? And why is it important? Where is it gone? And how do we get it back? Basically, trust in aerospace was already in jeopardy before COVID-19. And there's a lot that we've been seeing between OEMs and suppliers in terms of frustration. And now we have a real opportunity to redefine how we rebuild those relationships. And so I've got Justice Brees and John Ostrower joining us, talking about what they're doing to build trust with their customers. And we're going to be talking about tools for success and some initiatives that you can lead as we build our way out of this crisis.
Okay, well, thank you again for everybody. If you have inquiries, requests, or suggestions, that's how you reach me. And I would be delighted to proceed to help you with any of your additional questions. And thanks very much.